Chapter 9. The engineer who operated the shuttle that ran from the federal building to the government residential complex on Park Avenue always drove very carefully. His passengers were government employees and legislators, people with a considerable amount of clout. They wanted a smooth ride, and they didn't like being rattled around on the old tracks. A complaint would wind up costing him his job, so he made a habit of driving as if he were ferrying eggs. Consequently, he had plenty of time to brake when he saw the obstruction in the tunnel. His first thought was that the old tunnel had collapsed. Then he realized as he drew closer, the shuttle slowing down with a squeal of pneumatic brakes, that someone had run one of the old subway maintenance carts onto the track. For a moment, this puzzled him, as he knew that the intersecting side tunnel had been sealed off, but he wondered about it only for a moment. That was about all the time he had, because a man wearing a ski mask suddenly appeared on the tracks directly in front of him and emptied an automatic weapon directly into his window. The glass shattered into 1,000 fragments as the bullets punched through it, smashing into the engineer's face and chest, throwing him back against the wall of his tiny operator's cubicle. Another masked man leaped onto the coupling between the cars, climbed over the chains, and opened the door. He quickly made his way to the operator's cubicle, shoved the bloody body aside, and threw that lever that opened the passenger car doors. The passengers looked up in fear and disbelief as ski-masked men carrying assault rifles and pistols climbed up through the doors. One man in each car fired a burst into the ceiling to make sure he had their complete and undivided attention. They each said more or less the same thing. "All right, nobody move! Everybody does what they're told, and nobody gets hurt!" Congressman Julius K. Sanderson, the representative from New Jersey, was quick to respond to the situation. "Okay, everybody, take it easy," he said to his shocked and frightened colleagues. "Just do exactly what they say. Please don't anyone do anything foolish." "Yeah, do like the man said," said Rick Borodini through his ski mask. "Don't anybody do anything stupid." They didn't need to be told twice. They meekly climbed down out of the shuttle cars and onto the tracks, then allowed themselves to be herded down the side tunnel by the gunmen. As Polly had planned, it all went off without a hitch. Working from the downloaded file he'd been fed from Project Headquarters and Raven's description of the mansion and its grounds, Steele had drawn a detailed plan of the Borodini Enclave, which he laid out on the table for Ice and Raven to examine. "The entire harbor's mined," said Steele. "If we came in by boat, we could detect the mines if we had the right equipment and move slowly through, but that would leave us sitting ducks for the patrol boats and the gun batteries on the shore. And at night, they place searchlights out across the harbor. They'd let us come in about halfway, then simply blast us out right out of the water."
"How about along the shore?"
said Ice. Same problem," Steele said, staring at the map. "The grounds of the estate are surrounded by minefields, and they've got intruder alarms and automated weapons emplacements. And the grounds are highly illuminated at night. Same thing from the front. The only way in is up the front drive, and it's all open. You have minefields here and here, electrified gates, automated defense systems, armed perimeter guards, along with attack dogs, the works. And the estate itself is surrounded by the village that makes up the enclave. They've got armed guards with dogs patrolling the village streets. There's not much chance of getting through the village without being seen by someone. And the village itself is surrounded by this wall here, which they've got covered every 25 yards or so by sentry towers. They level the ground all around the outside of the wall. It's completely open and it's mined. The only way inside, and that's by the main road. And they've got that covered six ways from Sunday."
"Shit,"
said Ice.
"So how we get in there then? Choppers?"
"Their surface-to-air missile batteries would take out any chopper before it got close enough."
"So you're telling me that there ain't no way to hit him?"
said Ice. "No, there's a way," said Steele. "We've got to get inside the mansion and shut down their defense systems so Higgins can get his people in. Raven, that's where you come in. You're the only one who's actually been in there. We need to have a very detailed layout of the inside of the mansion, and as much as you can remember."
"Only on one condition,"
she said.
"I get to come along."
"We've been over that already," Steele said. "There's no way."
"I can take care of myself, and I know my way around inside there,"
she said.
"You want my help? You're gonna have to take me with you."
"Raven, look,
You think you're the only ones who've got a score to settle with the Borodinis?"
she said.
"I ain't gonna argue about it. Yes or no? What's it gonna be?"
The phone rang. Steele picked it up. "Steele," he said.
"Hello, scumbag. This is Tommy Borodini,"
said the voice on the other end.
"How did you get this number?"
"Shut up and listen. Turn on channel 7. I'll call you right back."
The line went dead. Steele hung up the phone.
"Who is that?"
asked Raven.
"Tommy B,"
Steele said. He turned on the TV. On their way back to Congress for a roll call vote, when they were abducted by an unknown number of armed men. The kidnappers apparently broke through one of the steel grates sealing off the tracks running from Government House to the Federal Building and gained access through one of the old abandoned subway tunnels, through which they spirited the kidnapped victims after they blocked off the tracks and killed the shuttle operator. At this moment, we do not yet know which members of the legislature or what other federal employees were among the kidnapped victims, but we expect to have that information for you momentarily. A short while ago, the station received a call from a man who identified himself as a member of the Delano family, claiming credit for the kidnapping and demanding a ransom for the victims in the amount of $10 million. Terms of the payment were not specified, and we are awaiting further word. Meanwhile, when we reached for comment at his family's enclave in Brooklyn, Anthony Delano vehemently denied any knowledge of the kidnapping and claimed that someone was trying to frame him. We have had, as yet, no official statement from the authorities. For further details, we now go to Linda Tellerman, standing by at the Federal Building.
Bob, when news of the abduction reached the chambers of Congress, the reaction here was shock and disbelief. The sheer audacity of this kidnapping has taken everyone by...
The telephone rang once more. Steele snatched it up.
Yeah?
Listen carefully, because I'm not going to repeat myself,
said Tommy B.
If you want to see any of these people alive again, you'll do exactly as I say.
If you think you're going to get away with this, said Steele, you must be out of your damn mind.
Shut the fuck up and listen. Your place is being watched. So you as much as make one move that I don't tell you to make, all those people are going to get iced. You listening?
I'm listening, said Steele tersely.
You've got exactly 1 hour to pick up the money. At that time...
There's no way anyone can get together $10 million in just 1 hour, Steele said. You've got to give me more time!
Don't hand me that. You just got to get it there or those people are dead meat. 1 hour. That's all you got. Have it delivered to your place. I'll call you back at that time with further instructions. If it ain't there by then or if I hear anything on the news about the Borodini family being behind this instead of the Delanos, you can kiss them goodbye.
He hung up the phone. Steele immediately dialed Higgins.
This is Steele. I need to talk to Higgins right away. It's an emergency.
He waited just a moment, then Higgins got on the line. Steele, I was just about to call you. You've heard about the kidnapping?
Yeah, I heard. Tommy B just called me. He's the one who pulled it off, not the Delanos. He wants the $10 million ready in an hour, and I'm supposed to be the brag man. I've got to sit tight until the money gets here. He's having my place watched. He wants the money delivered to me here. He said if it's not here when he calls back with further instructions, or if word gets out that he's behind this and not the Delanos, he's going to kill the hostages.
I see, said Higgins. Okay, how do you want to handle this?
Can you get the money?
I can get it. He could have held us up for a lot more than $10 million. You realize it's you he's really after. The money's only icing on the cake.
I know. Have it delivered to my place by X-Wing Chopper, Steele said. Get a hold of somebody approximately my physical type. Somebody who can pass for me at a distance. Have him armed and dressed in Strike Force riot gear. Get a hold of Gates and have me wire a voice synthesizer into the helmet mic. Program to sound like me. And have him hook up another one that can be slipped in place over a telephone receiver. Then have the guy come out here on the chopper. The chopper's going to drop him and the money off and pick us up. And I want you to come get scuba gear for me on the chopper as well. Can you do all that in an hour?
I'll manage, Higgins said. What's your plan?
Tommy B's probably figuring on running me around for a while to make sure I'm not being followed. I'm counting on that to buy us some time. Once he's got the money, those hostages are dead. So I figure our only chance is to grab a hostage of our own and force him to make a swap. We're going to hit the Enclave and snatch Victor Borodini.
Think you can pull it off?
I'll have to. Have an assault unit standing by with choppers within striking distance of the Enclave. I'll keep in touch with my broadcast link. The moment we've got their defenses systems neutralized, I'll give you the signal to hit the Enclave. Have you got all that?
I'm on it, Higgins said. Steele hung up the phone.
Okay,
he said, turning to Ice and Raven.
They forced our hand. We haven't got much time. So listen carefully. Here's what we're going to do.
As the chopper touched down in the penthouse helipad, they ducked down low and ran out to meet it. The man carrying the money got out of the hatch, dressed in full Strike Force riot gear.
Agent Sharp, reporting as ordered,
he said. The voice that came from the helmet speaker was Steele's own.
Do I sound all right?
You'll do, said Steele. I hope. You got the phone hookup?
Right here.
He tapped his pockets.
Good. Steele glanced at his watch. Borodini should be calling in about 10 minutes from now. Unless he jumps the gun, he's probably going to run you. But if it looks like you're running out of time or if he tumbles to it, get on to Higgins right away.
Got it.
And Sharp, watch yourself. If at some point he's going to run you right into a setup for an ambush, don't be a hero. Don't try to buy us time. If you smell anything wrong, get out of there and call Higgins right away.
Will do. Good luck.
You too.
They got into the chopper and lifted off. Steele immediately started stripping off his clothes. Ice and Raven watched with fascination as he loaded his built-in weapons through the magazine ports in his arms. He then slipped into the wetsuit and zipped it up, then strapped on the pouch containing the special belt designed for carrying his accessory hands. It had thick, specially built nice steel discs attached to it, with locking mechanisms similar to those on his wrists, sticking out from them and pointing downward, giving the belt the appearance of being studded with strange-looking metal conches. He reached into his pack and started to attach the accessory hands to the belt, snapping them into the locking discs so that he could remove them again with a quick twist. The effect was surreal. He slipped the belt back into the pouch and tucked his 45, his knife, and black fatigues and boots into the top of it. The X-Wing chopper headed out toward the north shore of Long Island, flying very low over the water, the waves practically licking at its underside as it skimmed over Long Island Sound. Its turbine NOTAR system substituted an internal blower for the old exposed tail rotor blade design, and it was constructed out of epoxy-impregnated fiberglass, graphite, and Kevlar, as strong as metal, but a fraction of the weight. Its X-Wing design gave it a sleek, aerodynamic teardrop shape. It could hover, take off, and land vertically using a helicopter-style rotor, but once in flight and moving at 200 miles per hour, the four-bladed graphite fiber composite rotor blade stopped and locked into a position, functioning as a fixed X-shaped wing, turning the chopper into a jet and enabling it to approach the speed of sound. The pilot, his head completely encased in his VCASS helmet, monitored the graphic displays and fed to him by the visually coupled airborne systems simulator, his computer-enhanced vision giving him much more information and affording far better visibility than was possible with the naked eye or conventional instrumentation. The X-Wing chopper knifed its way over the water, sweeping around Sands Point and hurtling towards Center Island. Both Ice and Raven were dressed in black Strike Force fatigues with riot helmets and body armor. They were not carrying the computer backpacks with integral missile launchers into which the helmets were normally hooked, as there had been no time to train them in their use. Their helmets by themselves would afford them some protection, as well as give them night vision and enable them to communicate with one another. For weapons, they carried the 4.7mm laser-sighted caseless battle rifles with select fire systems capable of semi-automatic three-round bursts or full-auto 9mm magazine pistols and hand grenades in both fragmentation and incendiary. They carried spare magazine pouches on their belts and shoulder harnesses. Use of those weapons was not complicated, and Steele had checked them out as best he could in the limited time they had available. Ice had already had experience with automatic weapons from his days as leader of the Skulls, and he had used the Strike Force battle rifle once before when he and Steele had hit the warehouse. Raven, however, had never fired an automatic weapon, and Steele had spent most of the time they had teaching her the use of both the rail rifle and the machine pistol. Now, in the chopper, Steele took advantage of the time to give her some practice with live ammo, firing out over the water through the open hatch.
"You'll see that it has practically no recoil," he said. "The high-velocity caseless ammunition is completely consumed on firing, and the weapon's gas-vented, so you won't have any brass flying around. It recoils much less than a conventional pistol. Don't worry about semi-automatic fire or three-round burst. Just leave it on full auto. Hold it the way I showed you and spray your target. Go ahead. Try it."
Raven fired several bursts through the open hatch.
"No, like this,"
Steele said, taking the weapon from her hands and demonstrating.
"Sweep across your target. Here, try it again."
She squeezed off two more bursts.
"Like that?"
"Yeah, like that,"
said Steele, nodding. She picked him up on it quickly, but he was still worried about how she'd do in actual combat. He didn't think much of her chances, but it was her decision. And after what Tommy B had done to her, she had a right to be there.
"Just remember to stick close to Ice and concentrate on letting him take out anyone in front of you," he said. "You just watch his back and try not to shoot him."
"Yeah, I'd appreciate that,"
said Ice. Raven grimaced at them.
"Okay," said Steele. "Let's do some live ammo work with the machine pistol."
As she unholstered the machine pistol and checked the magazine, just the way he'd shown her, he wondered how well Sharp was doing. He sincerely hoped that Tommy B was taking full advantage of the situation and enjoying himself while he ran Sharp all over town. They needed all the time they could get. He could only hope Sharp wouldn't need to get blown up before they hit the mansion, or that Tommy B would not run out of patience. The first contact had gone well. Tommy Bordini had called the moment the chopper took off from the penthouse helipad. Sharp picked up the phone and quickly slipped the synthesizer adapter Gates had given him on over the receiver.
"Steele,"
he said.
"That chopper bring the money?"
Tommy B snapped.
"Yeah, I've got it here."
"Good boy. Now listen carefully. I ain't gonna say this twice. You've got 15 minutes to make it down to 3rd and 23rd. There's a phone booth on the corner. It's gonna ring four times. You don't pick it up by the fourth ring, the hostages are dead. Time starts now. Get moving."
Sharp hung up the phone, pulled on his helmet, snatched up the bag containing the money, and ran for the elevator, which the building security guards had standing by so he wouldn't have to wait for it. The moment the doors opened on the lobby floor, he sprinted out to the Strike Force patrol unit warmed up and waiting for him at the curb. He threw the bag inside and shifted into gear, powering down the street for a straight run down to 23rd Street. As he drove, he reached for the radio headset.
Hey, cue to bag, man. We read you. Go ahead.
First contact made. I'm heading down to 3rd and 23rd for a second contact at a phone booth on the corner. I've got 15 minutes. Keep the road clear.
Will do.
Bagman out.
The armored unit built up speed as it jounced over the potholes, sirens blaring. So far, so good, thought Sharp. Come on, Tommy. Be a prick. Run me ragged. Make me work for it. We need the goddamn time. The X-Wing chopper slowed down and hovered low over the water, mere feet above the sound. They were about 500 yards offshore, just around the bend of the north point of the harbor.
Okay, said Steele. If everything goes according to plan, I'll give you the signal the moment. I've got their defense system shut down, and their missile batteries out of commission. Then we get in there fast with the assault unit and hit them hard. Remember, I don't want any choppers firing on the mansion. We need Borodini alive. Ice, make sure they understand that.
I got it,
Ice said.
Good luck, man.
Thanks.
Raven came up to him quickly and gave him a fierce kiss.
Give him hell, Steele,
she said.
You just be careful, Steele said. Don't get carried away when it goes down. Remember what I told you.
I will.
He nodded, slipped the face mask over his head, and dropped down through the hatch. The chopper turned and started flying back to the rendezvous with the assault force as soon as Steele hit the water. There was no need for a weight belt. The weight of his Nysteel prosthetics made him start sinking at once. He slipped the breather onto his mouth and started swimming underwater, propelling himself faster and faster with strong kicks of his powerful Nysteel legs, cutting through the water like a shark. He switched in his thermal imager and infrared. He had a long swim ahead of him, and it would take him through a harbor full of mines, patrolled by gunboats that could be equipped with sonar that would pick him up if they came anywhere near him. He turned his hearing up full, listening for the sound of engines. So far, so good, he thought. If only Tommy B gave him enough time. End of chapter.